I found myself staring at his pants legs, unable to look up. He lit a cigarette and came down to my level, perching on the curb. I hugged my knees, feeling numb. I barely know the man, but what I've seen of him I've always liked. He looks like a cross between a Jew and an Indian. A large, flat face, high cheekbones, a big hooked nose. He's a big man, probably 45, with a cop haircut, cop clothes, a deep rumbling voice.
"You want to bring me up to speed on this?" he said.
It was the act of opening my mouth to speak that brought the tears. I held myself in check, willing them back. I shook my head, struggling with a nearly overwhelming rush of regret. He handed me a handkerchief, and I pressed it to my eyes, then folded it, addressing my remarks to the oblong of white cotton. There was an F embroidered in one corner with a thread coming loose.
"Sorry," I murmured. "That's okay. Take your time."
"He was such a screw-up," I said. "I guess that's what gets me. He thought he was so smart and so tough." I paused. "I guess you never know which people will affect your life," I said.
"He never said who shot him?"
I shook my head. "I didn't ask. I didn't want the last minutes of his life taken up with that stuff. I'm sorry."
"Well, he might not have said anyway. What was the setup?"
I started talking, saying anything that came to mind. He let me ramble till I finally took control of myself and began to lay it out systematically. After hundreds of reports, I know the drill. I cited chapter and verse while he nodded, making notes in a battered black notebook. When I finished, he tucked his ballpoint pen away and shoved the notebook back into the inside pocket of his suit coat. He got up, and I rose with him automatically.
"What next?" I asked. "Actually, I got Daggett's file sitting on my desk," he said. "Rob told me you tagged it a homicide, and I thought I'd take a look. We had a double killing, one of those execution-style shootings up on the bluffs late yesterday, and we've had to put a lot of manpower on that one, so I haven't had a chance as yet. It'd help if you came down to the station and talked to Lieutenant Dolan yourself."
"Let me see Billy's sister first," I said. "This is the second brother she's lost in the whole Daggett mess."
"You don't think there's any chance she's the one who plugged him?"
I shook my head. "I thought she might connect to Daggett's death, but I can't picture her involved in this. Unless I'm missing something big. For one thing, he wouldn't have to meet her out in public like this. It was someone at the funeral, I'm almost sure."
"Make a list and we'll take it from there," he said.
I nodded. "I can also stop by the office and make some copies of my file reports. And Lavella may know more than she's told us so far." It felt good, turning everything over to him. He could have it all, Essie and Lavella and the Smiths. Pettigrew approached, holding a small plastic Ziploc bag by one corner. In it were three empty brass casings.
"We found these over by that pickup truck. We're sealing off the whole parking lot until the guys have a chance to go over it."
I said, "You might check the trash bins. That's where I found the skirt and shoes after Daggett was killed." Feldman nodded, then gave the shells a cursory look.
32s, he remarked.
I felt a cold arrow shoot up my spine. My mouth went dry.
"My 32 was stolen from my car a few days ago," I said. "Gutierrez took the report."
"A lot of 32s around. But we'll keep that in mind," Feldman said to me, and then to Pettigrew. "Let's hustle these folk out of here. And be polite."
Pettigrew moved away, and Feldman turned to study me.
"Are you all right?"
I nodded, wishing I could sit down again, afraid once I did I'd be stuck.
"Anything you want to add before I let you go?"
I closed my eyes for a moment, thinking back. I know the snapping sound a 32 makes when fired, and the shots I'd heard weren't like that. "The shots," I said, "they sounded odd to me, hollow, more like a pop than a bang."
"A silencer?"
"I've never heard one except on TV," I said sheepishly.
"I'll have the lab take a look at the slugs, though I don't know where anybody'd get a silencer in this town."
He made another quick note in his book. "You can probably order one from the back of a magazine," I said.
"Ain't that the truth?" The photographer was snapping pictures, and I could see Feldman's gaze flick in that direction.
Let me tend to this guy. He's new. I want to make sure he covers everything I need.
He excused himself and crossed to Billy's body, where he engaged in a conversation with the forensic photographer, using gestures to describe the various angles he wanted. Maria Gutierrez came up to me.
We're going out to the trailer park. Jerry said you might want to come.
I'll follow in my car, I said. You know where it is?
We know the park. We can meet you there if you want.
I'm going to see if Billy's car is here in the lot. I'll be along shortly, but don't wait on my account.
Right, she said.
I watched them pull out, and then I worked my way through the lot, checking the vehicles in the area adjacent to the boat launch. I spotted the Chevy three rows from the entrance, tucked between two RVs. The temporary sticker was still on the windshield. The windows were down. I stuck my head in without touching anything. The car looked clean to me, nothing in the front seat, nothing in the back. I went around to the passenger window and peered in, checking the floorboards from that side. I don't even know what I was hoping for. A hint? Some suggestion of where we might go from here? It looked as if Feldman might initiate a formal investigation after all, and glad as I was to turn it over to him, I still couldn't quite let go. I stopped by my car and picked up the skirt and shoes, which I handed over to Lieutenant Feldman. I told him where to find Billy's car, and then I finally got back in mine and took off. In my heart, I knew I'd been stalling to allow Pettigrew and Gutierrez a chance to deliver the news of Billy's death. That has to be the worst moment in anybody's life, finding two uniformed cops at your door, their expressions somber, voices grave. By the time I got to the trailer park, the word had apparently spread. By some telepathic process, people were collecting in twos and threes, all staring at the trailer uncomfortably, chatting in low tones. The trailer door was closed, and I heard nothing as I approached, but my appearance had generated conversation at my back. A fellow stepped forward.
"You a family friend? Because she's had bad news. I wasn't sure if you were aware," he said.
"I was there," I said. "She knows me." "How long ago did the officers leave?"
2 minutes. They were real good about it. Talked to her a long time, making sure she was all right. "I'm Fritzy Roderick. I manage the park," he said, offering me his hand.
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. "Is anybody with her now?"
"I don't believe so, and we haven't heard a peep. We were just talking among ourselves here, the neighbors and all, wondering if someone ought to sit with her."
"Is Lavella in there?"
"I don't know the name. Is she a relative?"
"Billy's ex-girlfriend," I said. "Let me see if I can find out what's going on. If she needs anything, I'll let you know."
"I'd appreciate that. We'd like to help any way we can."
I knocked at the trailer door, uncertain what to expect. Coral opened it a crack, and when she saw it was me, she let me in. Her eyes were reddened, but she seemed in control. She sat down on a kitchen chair and picked up her cigarette, giving the ash a flick. I sat down on the banquette.
"I'm sorry about Billy," I said.
She glanced at me briefly.
"Did he know?"
"I think so.
When I found him, he was already in shock and fading fast. I don't think he suffered much, if that's what you're asking."
"I'll have to tell Mom. The two cops who came said they'd do it, but I said no."
Her voice trailed off, hoarse from grief or the head cold.
"He always knew he'd die young, you know? Like when we'd see old people on the street, crippled or feeble. He said he'd never end up like them. I used to beg him to straighten up his act. But he had to do everything his way."
She lapsed into silence.
"Where's Lavella?"
"I don't know," Coral said. "The trailer was empty when I got here."
"Coral, I wish you'd fill me in. I need to know what was going on. Billy told me three different versions of the same tale."
"Why look at me? I don't know anything."
"But you know more than I do."
"That wouldn't take much."
"Level with me, please. Billy's dead now. There's nothing left to protect, is there?"
She stared at the floor for a moment, and then she sighed and stubbed out her cigarette. She got up and started clearing the table, running water in the tiny stainless steel kitchen sink. She squirted in ivory liquid, dropping silverware and plates into the mounting suds, talking in a low monotone as she worked.
"Billy was already up at San Luis when Daggett got there. Daggett had no idea Doug was related to us, so Billy struck up an acquaintance.
We were both of us bitter as hell.
Billy told me he and Doug were never close.
Bullshit! He just told you that so you wouldn't suspect him. The three of us were always thick as thieves.
So you did intend to kill him, I said.
I don't know. We just wanted to make him pay. We wanted to punish him.
We figured we'd find a way once we got close. Then Daggett's cellmate died, and he got all that money.
And you thought that would compensate?
Not me. I knew I'd never be happy till the day Daggett died, but I couldn't do it myself. I mean, kill someone in cold blood.
Billy was the one who said the money would help. We couldn't bring Doug back, but at least we'd have something.
He always knew Daggett lifted the cash, but he didn't think he'd get away with it.
Daggett gets out of prison, and sure enough, he's home free. He starts throwing money around.
Lavella calls Billy, and we decide to go for it.
So the guys up at San Luis never did figure it out, I said.
Nope.
Once Billy saw Daggett was in the clear, we decided to rip him off. And Lavella was part of it?
Coral nodded, rinsing a plate which he placed in the dish rack.
They got married the same week he got out, which suited us just fine. We figured if she didn't talk him out of it, she could steal it.
And failing that, what?
We never meant to kill anyone, she said. We just wanted the money. We didn't have much time anyway because he'd already spent part of it.
He went through $5,000 before we could bat an eye, and we knew if we didn't move fast, he'd blow the whole wad.
You didn't realize he intended to give the rest of it to Tony Gayen?
Of course not, she said with energy. Billy couldn't believe it when you told him about that. We thought most of it was still around somewhere. We thought we could still get our hands on it.
I watched her face, trying to compute the information she was giving me.
You mean you set Daggett up with Lavella so you could con him out of $25,000?
That's right, she said.
You were splitting it three ways. That's a little over $8,000 apiece.
So?
Coral, $8,000 is nothing.
Bullshit, it's nothing. Do you know what I could do with $8,000? How much do you have? Do you have $8,000?
No.
So, all right. Don't tell me it's nothing.
All right, it's a fortune, I said. What went wrong?
Nothing at first. Billy called him up and said the guys at San Luis heard about the money and they wanted it back.
He told Daggett they were coming after him, so that's when Daggett split.
How'd you know he'd hightail it up here?
Billy told Daggett he'd help him out, she said with a shrug.
And then when Daggett got into town, Billy started working on him, trying to get him to fork it over to us. He said he'd act as a go-between, smooth it all over and get him off the hook.
He'd already given it to me at that point, right?
Sure, but we didn't know that. He acted like he still had it handy. He acted like he might turn it over to Billy, but that was all crap. Of course, he was drunk all the time by then.
So he was conning you while you conned him.
He was just stringing us along, she said indignantly. Billy met him Tuesday night, and Daggett was real cagey. Said he needed time to get his hands on it. Said he'd bring it in Thursday night, so Billy met him at the hub again, only Daggett said he needed one more day.
Billy really laid into him. He said these guys were getting very pissed and might kill Daggett anyway, whether he gave them the money or not. Daggett got real nervous and swore he'd have it the next night, which was Friday.
The night he died.
Right. I was working that night, and I was supposed to keep an eye on him, which I did. Billy decided to come late just to make him sweat. And before I knew what was happening, this woman showed up, started buying him drinks.
You know the rest.
Billy told me you took some kind of cold cap and crashed in the back room. Was that true?
I was just laying low, she said. When I saw Daggett leave, I knew Billy'd have a fit. I already felt bad enough without putting up with his bullshit.
And Billy finally figured out who she was?
I don't know. I guess. I wasn't here this morning, so I don't know what he was up to.
Look, I have to go down to the police station and tell Lieutenant Dolan what's been going on. If Lavella comes back, please tell her it's urgent that she get in touch. Will you do that?
Coral wedged the last clean dish against the pile in the rack. She filled a glass with water and poured it over the lot of them, rinsing off the few remaining suds. She turned to look at me with a gaze that chilled.
Do you think she killed Billy?
I don't know.
Will you tell me if you find out it's her?
Coral, if she did it, she's dangerous.
I don't want you in the middle of this.
But will you tell me?
I hesitated.
Yes. Thank you.
Chapter 25. The Last Chapter. I had a brief chat with the manager of the trailer park. I gave him my card and asked him to call me if Lavella came back. I didn't really trust Coral to do it. The last I saw of him, he was tapping at her door. I got in my car and headed over to the police station. I asked for Lieutenant Dolan at the desk, but he and Feldman were in a section meeting. The clerk buzzed Jonah for me, and he came as far as the locked door, admitting me into the corridor beyond. Both of us were circumspect, pleasant, noncommittal. No one observing us could have guessed that mere hours ago we'd been cavorting stark naked on my Wonder Woman sheets.
"What happened when you got home?" I asked.
"Nothing. Everybody was asleep," he said.
"We have something in the lab you might want to see."
He moved down the hall to the right, and I followed. He looked back at me.
"Feldman had the guys check the trash bins at your suggestion. We think we found the silencer."
"You did?" I said, startled. He opened the half-door into the crime lab, holding it out for me as I passed in front of him. The lab tech was out, but I could see Billy's bloody shirt, tagged, on the counter, along with an object I couldn't at first identify.
"What's that?" I said.
"Is that it?" What I was looking at was a large plastic soft drink bottle, painted black, lying on its side, with a hole visible in the bottom.
"A disposable silencer, handmade. A sound suppressor, in effect. It's been wiped clean of prints," Jonah said.
"I don't understand how it works."
"I had to have Kruger explain it to me. The bottle's filled with rags. Take a look. The barrel of the gun is usually wrapped with tape, and the bottle affixed to it with a 1-inch hose clamp. The soda bottle has a reinforced bottom, but it's only effective for a few shots because the noise level increases each time as the exit hole gets larger. Obviously, the device works best at close range."
"God, Jonah, how do people know about these things? I never heard of it."
He picked up a paper-bound booklet from the counter behind me, flipping through it carelessly so I could see. Every page was filled with diagrams and photographs, illustrating how disposable silencers could be made out of common household objects.
"This is from a gun shop down in Los Angeles," he said. "You ought to see what you can do with a length of window screen or a pile of old bottle caps."
"Jesus!"
Lieutenant Becker stuck his head in the door. "Line one for you," he said to Jonah, and then disappeared. Jonah glanced at the lab phone, but the call hadn't been transferred.
"Let me take this and I'll be right back," Jonah said. "Hang on."
"Right," I murmured. I leaned toward the silencer, trying to remember where I'd seen something similar. Through the hole in the bottom, I caught a glimpse of the blue terry cloth filling the interior. When I realized what it was, my mental processes clicked in, and the interior machinery fired up. I knew. I straightened up and crossed to the door, checking the corridor, which was empty. I headed for my car. I could still see Ramona Westfall coming up the basement stairs with an armload of ragged blue bath towels, which she dumped on the chair. The plastic bottle had been filled with a soft drink, which she nearly dropped as she passed it to Tony to refrigerate. I stopped by the office long enough to try the Westfall's number. The phone rang four times, and then the machine clicked in.
"Hello, this is Ramona Westfall. Neither Farron nor I can come to the phone right now, but if you'll leave your name, telephone number, and a brief message, we'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thank you."
I hung up at the sound of the tone. I checked my watch. It was 4:45. I had no idea where Ramona was, but Tony had a 5 o'clock appointment just a few blocks away. If I could intercept him, I could lean on him some about her alibi, since he represented the only confirmation she had. How had she pulled it off? He had to be on heavy medication for the migraine, so she might have slipped out while he was sleeping, adjusting the kitchen clock when she got back so she'd be covered for the time of Daggett's death. Once she was home again, Tony had wakened. She'd probably made sure of that so she'd have someone to corroborate the time. She'd fixed the sandwiches, chatting pleasantly while he ate, and as soon as he went back to bed, she changed the clock again.
Or maybe it wasn't even as complicated as that. Maybe the watch Daggett wore had been set for 2:37 and then submerged. She could have killed him earlier and been home by 2 o'clock. Tony may have realized what she'd done and tried to shield her when he understood how close my investigation was bringing me. It was also possible that he was in cahoots with her, but I hoped that wasn't the case. I locked my office and went down the front stairs, trotting up State Street on foot. The Granger building was only 3 blocks up, and it made more sense than hopping in my car and driving all the way around to the parking lot behind the building. Tony might still be hanging out at the arcade across the street. I had to get to him before she had a chance to intercept. I didn't want him going home. She had to realize things were getting hot, especially since I'd shown up at the house with the shoes and skirt. All I needed from him was an indication I was on the right track, and then I'd call Feldman. I thought about the clothes, which I knew would be gloomy with the gathering twilight. I didn't want to go back there unless I had to. I checked the arcade. Tony was at the rear, on the right-hand side, playing a video game. He was concentrating fully, and I didn't think he was aware of me. I waited, watching small creatures being blasted off the screen. His scores weren't that good, and I was tempted to have a try at it myself. The creature suddenly froze into place, random weapons firing off here and there without regard to his manipulations. He looked up.
"Oh, hi."
"I need to talk to you," I said. His eyes moved to the clock.
"I've got an appointment in 5 minutes. Can it wait?"
"I'll walk you over. We can talk on the way." He picked up his package, and we moved out to the street. The fading afternoon sun seemed bright after the darkness of the arcade. Even so, the fog was rolling in, November twilight beginning to descend. I punched the button at the crosswalk, and we waited for the light to change. "Last Friday, the night Daggett died, do you remember where your uncle was?"
"Sure. Milwaukee, on a business trip."
"Are you on medication for the migraines?"
"Well, yeah. Tylenol with codeine. Compazine if I'm throwing up."
"How come?" "Is it possible your aunt went out while you slept?"
"No, I don't know."
"I don't understand what you're getting at," he said. I thought he was stalling, but I kept my mouth shut. We'd reached the Granger building, and Tony moved into the lobby ahead of me. The elevator that had been out of order was now in operation, but the other one was immobilized, doors open, the housing visible, 2 sawhorses in front of the opening with a warning sign. Tony was watching me warily.
"Did she say she went out?"
"She claimed she was home with you."
"So?"
"Come on, Tony, you're the only alibi she has. If you were zonked on medication, how do you know where she was?" He pressed the elevator button. The doors opened and we got on. The doors closed without incident, and we went up to 6. I checked his face as we stepped into the hallway. He was clearly conflicted, but I didn't want to press just yet. We headed down the corridor toward the suite his psychiatrist apparently occupied.
"Is there anything you want to talk about?" I asked.
"No," he said, his voice breaking with indignation. "You're crazy if you think she had anything to do with it." "Maybe you can explain that to Feldman. He's in charge of the case."
"I'm not talking to the cops about her," Tony said.
He tried the office door and found it locked.
"Shit, he's not here."
There was a note taped to the door. He reached up to snatch the piece of paper, turning the movement into an abrupt shove. Next thing I knew, I was on my hands and knees, and he'd taken off. He banged on the elevator button and then veered right. I was up and running when I heard the door leading to the stairway slam back against the wall. I ran banging into the stairwell only seconds after he did. He was already heading up.
"Tony, come on, don't do this."
He was moving fast, his footsteps scratching on the concrete stairs. His labored breathing echoed against the walls as he went up. I don't keep fit for nothing, folks. He had youth on me, but I was in good shape. I flung my bag aside and grabbed the rail, starting up after him, mounting the steps 2 at a time. I peered upward as I ran, trying to catch sight of him. He reached the 7th floor and kept on going. How many floors did this building have?
"Tony, goddammit, wait up! What are you doing?"
I heard another door bang up there. I stepped up my pace. I reached the landing at the top. The elevator repairman had apparently left the door to the attic unlocked, and Tony had shot through the gap, slamming the door behind him. I snatched the handle, half expecting to find it locked. The door flew open, and I pushed through, pausing on the threshold. The space was dim and hot and dry, largely empty except for a small door opening off to my right where the elevator brake, sheave, and drive motors were located. I ducked my head into the cramped space briefly, but it appeared to be empty. I pulled out and peered around. The roof was another 20 feet up, the rafters steeply pitched, timbers forming a 90-degree angle where they met. Silence. I could see a square of light on the floor, and I looked up. A wooden ladder was affixed to the wall to my right. At the top, a trap door was open, and waning daylight filtered down. I scanned the attic. There was an electrical panel sitting on some boxes. It looked like some kind of old light board from the theater on the ground floor. For some reason, there was a massive papier-mâché bird standing to one side. A blue jay, wearing a painted business suit. Wooden chairs were stacked, seat to seat, to my left.
Tony?
I put a hand on one of the ladder rungs. He might well be hiding somewhere, waiting for me to head up to the roof so he could ease out and down the steps again. I started up, climbing maybe 10 feet so I could survey the attic from a better vantage point. There was no movement, no sound of breathing. I looked up again and started climbing cautiously. I'm not afraid of heights, but I'm not fond of them either. Still, the ladder seemed secure, and I couldn't figure out where else he might be. When I got to the top, I pulled myself into a sitting position and peered around. The trap came out in a small alcove, hidden behind an ornamental pediment with a matching pediment halfway down the length of the roof. From the ground, the two of them had always looked strictly decorative, but I could see now that one disguised a brace of air vents. There was only a very narrow walkway around the perimeter of the roof, protected by a short parapet. The steep pitch of the roof would make navigating hazardous. I peered down into the attic, hoping to see Tony dart out of hiding and into the stairwell. There was no sign of him up here, unless he'd eased around to the far side. Gingerly, I got to my feet, positioning myself between the nearly vertical roofline on my left and the ankle-high parapet on my right. I was actually walking in a metal rain gutter that popped and creaked under my weight. I didn't like the sound. It suggested that any minute now the metal would buckle, toppling me off the side. I glanced down 8 floors to the street, which didn't seem that far away. The buildings across from me were 2 stories high and lent a comforting illusion of proximity, but pedestrians still seemed dwarfed by the height. The street lights had come on, and the traffic below was thinning. To my right, half a block away, the bell tower at the Axminster Theater was lighted from within, the arches bathed in tawny gold and warm blue. The drop had to be 80 feet. I tried to remember the velocity of a falling object. Something, something per foot per second was as close as I could come, but I knew the end result would be an incredible splat. I paused where I was and raised my voice.
Tony!
I caught a flash of movement out of the corner of my eye, and my heart flew into my throat. The plastic bag he'd been carrying was eddying downward, floating lazily. Coming from where? I peered over the parapet. I could see one of the niches that cut into the wall just below the cornice molding. The frieze that banded the building had always looked like marble from the street, but I could see now that it was molded plaster, the niche itself down about 4 feet and to the left. A half shell extended out maybe 15 inches at the bottom edge, and it held what was probably meant to be some sort of lamp with a torch flame, all molded plaster like the frieze. Tony was sitting there, his face turned up to mine. He'd climbed over the edge, and he was now perched in the shallow ornamental niche, his arm locked around the torch, legs dangling. He'd taken a wig out of the bag he carried, donning it, looking up at me with a curious light in his eyes. I was looking at the blonde who'd killed Daggett. For a moment we stared at each other, saying nothing. He had the cocky look of a 10-year-old defying his mom, but under the bravado I sensed a kid who was hoping someone would step in and save him from himself. I put a hand on the pediment to steady myself.
You coming up, or shall I come down?
I kept my tone matter-of-fact, but my mouth was dry.
I'll be going down in a minute.
Maybe we could talk about that, I said.
It's too late, he said, smiling impishly. I'm poised for flight.
Will you wait there until I reach you?
No grabbing, he warned.
I won't grab.
My palms were damp, and I wiped them on my jeans. I squatted, turning to face the roof, extending a foot tentatively down along the frieze. I glanced down, trying to find some purchase. Garlands of pineapple, grapes, and fig leaves formed a bas-relief design that wound across the face of the building.
How'd you do this? I asked.
I didn't think about it. I just did it. You don't have to come down. It won't help.
I just don't want to talk to you hanging over the edge, I said, lying through my teeth.
I was hoping to get close enough to nab him, ignoring visions of grappling with him at that height. I steadied myself, tucking a toe into the shallow crevice formed by a curling vine. The niche was only 4 feet away. At ground level, I wouldn't have given it a thought. I sensed that he was watching me, but I didn't dare look. I held onto the parapet, lowering my left foot. He said,
"You're not going to talk me out of this."
"I just want to hear your side of it," I said.
"Okay."
"You won't try to kill me, will you?" I asked.
"Why would I? You never did anything to me."
"I'm glad you recognize that. Now I feel really confident."
I heard him laugh lightly at my tone. I've seen magazine pictures of a man who can climb a vertical cliff face in a pair of tennis shoes, holding himself with the tips of his fingers tucked into small cracks that he discovers as he ascends. This has always seemed like a ludicrous pursuit, and I usually flip to an article that makes more sense. The sight of the photographs makes me hyperventilate, especially the ones taken from his vantage point, staring down into some yawning crevasse. Maybe, if the truth be known, I'm more anxious about heights than I let on. I allowed my right foot to inch down again as far as the lip of the niche. I found a handhold, down into the right. Felt like a pineapple, but I wasn't sure. Pinning my safety to a phony piece of fruit. I had to be nuts. The hardest part was actually letting go of the coping once my foot was resting safely in the recess. I had to bend my knees, turning slightly to the right, sinking little by little until I could take a seat. Tony, ever gallant, actually gave me a hand, steadying me until I eased down next to him. I'm not a brave soul. I'm really not. I just didn't want him flying off the side of that building while I looked on. I locked my left arm around the torch, just below his, holding onto my wrist with my right hand. I could feel sweat trickle down my sides. "I hate this," I said. I was winded, not from effort, but from apprehension.
"It's not bad. Just don't look down."
Of course I did. The minute he said that, I had an irresistible desire to peek. I was hoping somebody would spot us, like they always do on TV. Then the cops would come with nets and the fire engines would arrive and somebody would talk him out of this. I'm an organism of the earth, a Taurus. I was never born of air, of water, or of fire. I'm a creature of gravity, and I could feel the ground whisper. The same thing happens to me in old hotels when I'm staying on the 22nd floor. I open a window and want to fling myself out.
"Oh, Jesus, this is such a bad idea," I said.
"For you, maybe. Not for me."
I tried to think back to my short life as a cop and the standard procedure for dealing with potential suicides. Stall for time was the first rule. I didn't recall anything about hanging your ass off the side of a building, but here I was. I said,
"What's the story, babe? You want to tell me what's been going on?"
"There's not much to it. Daggett called the house on Monday. Aunt Ramona made a note of the number, so I called him back. I dreamed about killing him. I couldn't wait. I had fantasies for months, every night before I went to sleep. I wanted to catch him with a wire around his neck and twist till it bit into his windpipe and his tongue bugged out. It doesn't take that long. I forget what that's called now."
"Garrotting," I supplied.
"Yeah, I would have liked that. But then I figured it was better if it looked like an accident, because that way I could get away with it."
"Why'd he call?"
"I don't know," Tony said uncomfortably. "He was drunk and blubbering, said he was sorry and wanted to make it up to me for what he did. I go, 'Fine, why don't we meet and talk?' And he goes, 'It would mean so much to me, son.'"
Tony was acting out the parts, using a quavering falsetto for Daggett.
So then I tell him I'll meet him the next time at this bar he's calling from, the Hub, which didn't give me much time to put together this get-up.
Was that Ramona's skirt?
Nah, I got it at the Salvation Army thrift store for $1. The sweater was another 50 cents, and the shoes were $2.
Where'd the sweater go?
I tossed it in another trash can a block away from the first. I thought it would all end up at the dump.
What about the wig?
That was Aunt Ramona's from years ago. She didn't even know it was gone.
Why'd you keep it?
I don't know. I was going to put it back in her closet where I got it, in case I needed it again. I had it on at the beach, but then I remembered Billy already knew who I was.
He broke off, obviously confused.
I might have told my shrink about the whole thing if he'd been here. Anyway, the wig's expensive. This is real hair.
The color's nice, too, I said. I mean, where else could I go with this? Even Tony recognized the absurdity, and he flashed me a look.
You're humoring me, right?
Of course I'm humoring you, I snapped. I didn't come down here so we could have an argument. He did a half-shrug, smiling sheepishly. I said,
Did you actually meet him there Tuesday night?
Not really. I went. I had it all worked out by then. Only when I walk in, he's sitting at this table talking to some guy. Turned out to be Billy Polo, but I didn't know it at the time. Billy was sitting in this booth with his back to the door. I saw Daggett, but I didn't realize he had company till I was right there in front of him. I veer off the minute I spot Billy, but by then he's had a good look at me. I'm not worried. I figure I'll never see him again anyway. I hang around for a while, but they're really into it. I can tell Billy's leaning all over him, and it isn't likely to let up. So, I take a hike and go home.
Was this one of the nights you had a migraine?
Yeah, he said. I mean, some are real and some are fake, but I have to have a pattern, know what I mean? So I can come and go as I please.
How'd you get down to the Hub? By cab?
My bike. The night I killed him, I rode down and left it at the marina, and then I called a cab from a payphone and took it over to the Hub.
How'd you know he'd show up?
Because he called again, and I said I'd be there.
He never twigged to the fact that you'd showed up the first time in drag?
How was he going to know? He hadn't seen me since way before the trial. I was 12, 13, something like that. A fat boy back then. I figured even if he guessed, I'd do it anyway. Kill his ass. And once he was dead, who would know?
What went wrong?
His brow furrowed. I don't know. Well, I do. The plan went fine. It was something else.
His eyes met mine, and he looked every bit of 15, the blonde wig adding softness and dimension to a face that was nearly formless with youth. I could see how he'd pass as a woman, slim, with a clear complexion, sweet smile on his wide mouth. He looked down at the street, and for a moment I thought he meant to swing out into space.
When I was 8, I had these pet mice, he said. Really sweet. I kept him in this cage with a wheel and a water bottle hanging upside down. Mom didn't think I'd take care of him, but I did. I'd cut up strips of paper in the bottom of the cage so they could nest. Anyway, the girl mouse had these babies. They couldn't have been as long as this.
He was indicating the end of his little finger.
Bald, he went on. Just little bitty old things. We had to go out of town one weekend, and when we got back, the cat had tried to get in the cage. Knocked it off the desk and everything. The mice were gone. Probably the cat got him, except for this one that had been laying in all these paper shreds. Well, the water had spilled, so the paper was damp, and the little thing must have had pneumonia or something, because it was panting, like it couldn't breathe good. I tried to keep it warm. I watched it for hours, and it just kept getting worse and worse. So I decided I'd better, you know, do away with it, so it wouldn't suffer any more.
He leaned forward, swinging his feet back and forth.
Don't do that, I murmured anxiously. Finish the story. I want to know what happened next.
He looked over at me then, his tone of voice mild.
I tossed it in the toilet. That's the only way I could think of to kill it. I couldn't crush it.
so I just figured I'd flush it away. The little thing was half dead anyway, and I thought I'd be doing it a favor, putting it out of its misery. But before I could do it, that little tiny hairless baby started struggling. You could tell it was in a total panic, trying to get out of there, like it knew what was happening.
He paused, dashing at his eyes.
Daggett did that, and now I can't get away from the look on his face, you know? I see it all day long. He knew, which was fine with me. I wanted that. I wanted him to know it was me, and his life wasn't worth 2 cents. I just didn't think he'd care. He was a drunk and a bum, and he killed all those people. He should have died. He should have been glad to go. I was putting him out of his misery, you know? So why'd he have to make it so hard?
He fell silent, and then he let out a deep breath.
Anyway, that's how that went. I can't sleep anymore. I dream about that stuff. Makes me sick.
What about Billy? I assumed he figured it out when he saw you at the funeral.
Yeah, that was weird. He didn't give a shit about Daggett, but he felt like he should get part of the money if he kept his mouth shut. I would have given him all of it, but I didn't believe him. You should have seen him, swaggering around making all these threats. I figured he'd start bragging one night about what he knew, and there I'd be.
The edge of the niche was beginning to cut into my rear end. I was hanging on so tightly that my arm was getting numb, but I didn't dare ease up. I couldn't figure out how to get us out of this, but I knew I'd better start talking fast.
I killed a man once, I said.
I meant to say more, but that's all I could get out. I clamped my teeth together, trying to force the feelings back down where I'd been keeping them. It surprised me that after all this time it was still so painful to think about.
On purpose?
I shook my head.
Self-defense. But dead is dead.
His smile was sweet.
You can always come with me.
Don't say that. I'm not going to jump, and I don't want you to either. You're 15 years old. There are lots of other ways out.
I don't think so.
Your parents have money. They could hire Melvin Belly if they wanted to.
My parents are dead.
Well, the Westfalls, then. You know what I mean.
But, Kinsey, I murdered 2 people, and it's first degree because I looked it up. How am I going to get away with that?
The way half the killers in this country do, I said with energy. Hell, if Ted Bundy's still alive, why shouldn't you be?
Who's he?
Never mind. Someone who did a lot worse than you. He thought for a moment.
I don't think it would work. I hurt too bad, and I don't see the point.
There isn't a point. That's the part you invent.
Could you do me a favor?
All right, what's that?
Could you tell my aunt I said goodbye? I meant to write her a note, but I didn't have a chance.
God damn it, Tony, don't do this. She's had enough pain.
I know, he said, but she's got my Uncle Farron, and they'll be okay. They never really knew what to do with me anyway.
Oh, I see. You've got this all worked out.
Well, yeah, I do. I've been reading up on this stuff, and it's no big deal. Kids kill themselves all the time.
I hung my head, almost incapable of framing a response.
Tony, listen, I said finally. What you're talking about is dumb, and it doesn't make any sense. Do you have any idea how crummy life seemed when I was your age?
I cried all the time, and I felt like shit. I was ugly, I was skinny, I was lonely, I was mad. I never thought I'd pull out of it, but I did. Life is hard, life hurts. So what? You tough it out. You get through, and then you'll feel good again. I swear to God.
He tilted his head, watching me intently. I don't think so. Not for me. I'm in too deep. I can't bear any more. It's too much.
Tony, there are days when none of us can bear it, but the good comes around again. Happiness is seasonal like anything else. Wait it out. There are people who love you. People who can help.
He shook his head. I can't do that. It's kind of like I made a deal with myself to go through with this. She'll understand.
I could feel my temper snapping. You want me to tell her that? You took a flying leap because you made a fucking deal with yourself?
His face clouded with uncertainty.
I pressed on in a softer tone. You want me to tell her we sat up here like this and I couldn't talk you out of it? I can't let you do it. You'll break her heart. He looked down at his lap, his eyes remote, face coloring up the way boys do in lieu of tears.
"It doesn't have anything to do with her. Tell her it was me, and she did just great. I love her a lot, but it's my life, you know?"
I was silent for a moment, trying to figure out where to go next. His face brightened, and he held up an index finger.
"I nearly forgot. I have a present for you."
He shifted, letting go of the torch, with a move that made me snatch at him instinctively. He laughed at that.
"Take it easy. I'm just reaching in the waistband of my jeans."
I looked to see what he'd produced. My 32 lay across his palm. He held his hand out so I could take it, realizing belatedly that I couldn't free up a hand to reach for it.
"That's okay. I'll put it right here," he said kindly.
He set it in the niche behind the ornamental torch I was clinging to.
"How'd you get it?"
"Stalling, stalling."
"Same way I did everything else. I used my head. You put your home address on that business card you gave Aunt Ramona. So I rode over on my bike and waited till you got home. I was going to introduce myself, you know, and act like this real polite kid with good manners and a nifty haircut and stuff like that. Real innocent. I wasn't sure how much you knew, and I thought maybe I could steer you off. I saw the car, and you almost stopped, but then you took off again. I had to pedal my ass off to keep up with you, and then you parked at the beach, and I saw a chance to go through your stuff."
"You killed Billy with that?"
"Yeah, it was handy, and I needed something quick."
"How'd you know about disposable silencers?"
"Some kid at school.
I can make a pipe bomb, too," he said. Then he sighed.
"I gotta go soon. Time's nearly up."
I glanced down at the street. It was really getting dark up here, but the sidewalk was bright. The arcade across the way lit up like a movie house. Two people on the far side of the street had spotted us, but I could tell they hadn't figured out what was going on. A stunt? A movie being shot? I looked at Tony, but he didn't seem to be aware. My heart began to bang again, and it made my chest feel tight and hot.
"I'm getting tired," I said casually. "I may go back up, but I need some help. Can you give me a hand?"
"Sure," he said, and then he paused, his whole body alert.
"This isn't a trick, is it?"
"No," I said, but I could hear my voice shake, and the lie cut my tongue like a razor blade. I've always lied with ease and grace, with ingenuity and conviction, and I couldn't get this one out. I saw him make a move. I grabbed him, hanging on for dear life, but all he had to do was give his arm a quick twist and my hand came loose. I reached again, but it was too late. I saw him push out, lifting off. For a moment he seemed to hover there, like a leaf. And then he disappeared from my line of sight. I didn't look down again after that. I thought I heard a siren wailing, but the sound was mine. I billed Barbara Daggett for $1,040, which she paid by return mail. It's nearly Christmas now, and I haven't slept well for 6 weeks. I've thought a lot about Daggett, and I've changed my mind about one thing. I suspect he knew what was going on. From a distance, Tony might have passed for a woman, but up close he looked like exactly what he was, a young kid playing dress-up, smart beyond his years, but not wise enough by half. I don't think Daggett was fooled. Why he went along with the game, I'm not sure. If he believed what Billy'd told him, he must have figured he was dead either way. Maybe he felt he owed Tony that last sacrifice. I'll never know. But it makes more sense to me that way. Some debts of the human soul are so enormous, only life itself is sufficient forfeit. Perhaps in this case, all of the accounts are now paid in full, except mine. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of D is for Deadbeat by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer. Additional titles by Sue Grafton in the Books on Tape Library include A is for Alibi and B is for Burglar. For additional information about them or for help with topics of related interest, please call our customer service department or check our catalog index to find review material.